Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. History class is often that class, you know, the one where the students tune out all of those names and dates that don't appear to figure much in their everyday lives. But it doesn't have to be that way. Columbus historian Doreen Juhas Sauer wants to change that. This year she worked with Fort Hays High School students on an oral history project about the Milo Grogan neighborhood, the once thriving Columbus community that fell on hard times after redlining in the 50s and 60s. WOSU Television's Columbus Neighborhoods highlights the project this week. Check out the link at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us is Columbus historian and education outreach coordinator for Columbus Landmarks, Doreen Juhas Sauer. Welcome.
Thank you.
I should say welcome back. You're on for lots of different shows throughout the year.
Thank you.
And Fort Hays High School junior Miles Balfour. Welcome to the show, Miles.
It's good to be here.
So, Miles, what did you think when they talked about an oral history project about Milo Grogan? Had you ever even heard of the neighborhood before?
I haven't heard of the neighborhood, but I was familiar with the location. On my way to school, I usually pass it. And when I heard about the opportunity to be in an oral history project, at first, I was a bit confused of it, but I wasn't scared of it. I was considering that it could be something very fundamental, but not only fundamental, but opportunistic for me.
Uh-huh. And why an oral history project, Doreen Juhas Sauer? What's the significance of the template you're using here?
Well, I have to give credit to two sources of inspiration. One is Dr. Milton Ruffin, who's the principal of Fort Hays, who had suggested that an oral history project at Milo Grogan might be just the thing. It's the closest neighbor that we have at Fort Hays, and it seems as if there should be a lot of hands across the railroad tracks that we should be offering. And we knew that it was an elderly population or an aging population, and if you don't capture their stories, you know, you don't hear it. So that was one inspiration. The second was that a teacher at Fort Hays, Eric East, who was there when I taught at Fort Hays, he and I have been working on history lesson plans, historic preservation lesson plans. And that's through Columbus Landmarks Foundation through a grant we got with the National Trust. And as strange as this may sound, it's not so much about getting kids interested in historic preservation by having them memorize styles of buildings, mm-hmm. but about really feeling like I know what the city is and I'm falling in love with it. And this is really important to me. And I should look at these neighborhoods that are often overlooked. And what better way to do that than we wrote a lesson, very ethereal at that point, about how to get started in a neighborhood, used it as an example. And then little did we know that we were going to embark on such a journey.
Why didn't you know that? What was surprising to you about that?
Well, we knew that it would probably work. We just didn't know that the opportunity would come for us to pilot it and that it would be accepted okay. in such a big way that when WOSU heard about it and they saw what the kids were doing and we had people invited over to school, at which Miles can tell you much more about, that everybody responded so positively that this thing suddenly grew. We were thinking it was going to be a small book of oral histories, and we are still working on the book. But in the meantime, we seem to have gone prime time into the movie, you know. So at this point, Hollywood will call next, and then we'll get the book done.
So, Miles, what surprised you about this project? What were you not expecting?
I wasn't expecting to meet so many people or the likes of people that I met. I met coaches for the LA Lakers. I met the president of the Fifth Third Bank. I just met people, and not only have I met people, but I feel like I personally changed a lot throughout the project.
How so?
I feel like I've been able to develop a better sense how to talk to people, but not only talk to people, but understand people. When you're listening to someone's past, when you're listening to someone's experience of history that they have personally lived through and experienced, that is 10 times more crucial, but not only crucial, but effective and impactful. Like, it's more impacting than reading a book. It's more impacting than just looking at a page and looking at history. When you listen to it, it's different.
It's like it's right down the street, right?
It's right down the yeah. street.
So you interviewed people for the project.
Yes.
What did you learn about the history of the area?
I learned that from the history of the area of Milo Grogan, I feel like the neighborhood has undergone a lot of change.
Yeah.
I feel like the people that have experienced the history, such as seeing the interstate get creative and dividing the neighborhoods mm-hmm. and the banks and not the banks, but the stores and businesses that came and went. When you listen to that or when you understand what someone has experienced, that's more, it uses empathy. You understand where someone is coming from.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about a project, an oral history project undertaken by students at the Fort Hays High School. You just heard from Miles Balfour. He is a Fort Hays High School student in the oral history project. It's about the Milo Grogan neighborhood. Also with us, Dori Neuhaus-Sauer. She's a Columbus historian and education outreach coordinator for Columbus Landmarks. She has taken charge and led this oral history project, but the students are doing the work, right?
Oh, the students are doing the work. I think it was my role was really just to provide a bit of a framework and to try to help make connections and to bring sort of perhaps the earlier history, like why is there a Milo? Why is there a Grogan? What happened to Grogan? And we knew Rick Mann from the Arts Castle already. We knew some of the commissioners. So we were very lucky to be able to kind of slide right into that. But there were surprises for us, too, those of us who thought we knew a little bit more about it. It's an old Irish neighborhood that's very connected with the railroads. And then it becomes an Italian community, African-American Italian community. What I think surprised us all was how real those roots are still there. And this is not just one population coming in and then they move and another comes in and then they move. These are ties that are all through the area. And a lot of the Italian families are very much still in touch with the neighborhood. And a lot of the African-American families remember who their house was bought from and there are still ties. I think that was the big surprise.
The big impact on the neighborhood was redlining?
It was one of the impacts of it. I would have to say that the thing that was already looming on the horizon for Milo Grogan had happened so long ago out of people's immediate memory that you could only see that this was going to how this was going to play out. Columbus really wanted Milo Grogan as part of the city. And from about 1890 to 1912, the city was knocking on Milo Grogan's door to have them vote to come in the city.
The annexation process that went on for many years.
And we always think of the 1950s as big annexation, but 1912 was huge annexation. And in part, Columbus didn't have money for infrastructure of older neighborhoods like what would be present-day German Village. So they needed a cash revenue coming in. So they were looking for these neighborhoods to annex, but the truth was, once annexed, yes, they would have given them some city services, but it was to industrialize them. And once you could have that industrial tax base, then you had much more of a stream of money coming into the city. And at the same time, it's prohibition. And so the one thing about Columbus, it's located in a cornfield. And prohibition, you just simply had to cross the city line to avoid whatever vice squad there might be that would shut down a speakeasy. And you just cross a street and you're in the country or you're in a township. And so these outskirts areas, whether they were south or north, represented a threat to the coming temperance movement.
It's hard to believe it was considered country.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Describe what the neighborhood's like now, Miles.
The neighborhood has undergone some changes. There's more of a art connection to it. When I drive, I don't drive yet. But when I'm on the bus and I go past Milo Grogan and I see this art gallery. Yeah, this is art gallery, and I see the art castle. To me, I just see that even though the neighborhood has undergone some hard times, it still has bright times now and to come. I'm really excited to see where the neighborhood goes, especially with arts.
I think that's probably the most interesting aspect of this is there's an investment now. And Miles mentioned that the word empathy that we don't often associate with history.
Right. Right.
Why do you think it makes a difference to learn this way, Doreen?
I think it's the way our brains work. I really do. I think it's part of that brain theory, and that's one thing that I think Fort Hays had always tried to give teachers connections to, starting at the very beginning when the high school came in. It was about how we learn. And once we can get it in our brain and we make those connections, we don't forget the lesson. That's why stories are so compelling. That's why even in historic preservation, a compelling story is absolutely important. Then we start to care. It's just a natural human reaction.
I thought you know, just being a journalist, one of the best things you taught them was about public records, you know, original or primary sources, right?
Right.
What kind of things did you look at when it came to the records?
I remember.
Miles? Oh.
For one was these MLA cars, looking at the houses and the buildings that were constructed and some of them that still remain. And then some of the people we interviewed, such as Jim Clemens, we asked them to look at it. Jim Clemens and Rodney Kent, we asked them to look at it, and they were just going on a nostalgia trip. They were just looking at some of the old places that their friends used to live, that they once visited. We also went to the main library downtown, and we were looking at some historical records. What were we looking at?
We've been looking at city directories and some of the old maps and the township maps. And when you trace Clinton Township out, you know, and Cleveland Avenue out on early maps, you can find places where there were orchards. And it just sort of blows your mind that you're right. You had said before it was country. And the MLS cards that Miles is referring to were a lucky find. And this was cards from the 1950s to 1970s of houses that were bought and sold in Columbus. They were in a Bexley real estate office, and they were saved. They're being scanned by the Columbus Public Library downtown now. And on the back of the card, if the house was purchased or sold in that time period, and some of them two or three times, it told you what the price was, but it might also give you clues to who was welcome there or why people were leaving. And a lot of these houses, of course, are gone. So to see these are like little black and white real estate ads that offer you a snapshot.
Give me an example of why a clue that someone, why they were leaving. What kind of clue are you talking about?
Well, one of the things that you start to notice, and if you take this citywide, not just Milo Grogan, is you start to see patterns that are an aging population. A lot of people saying, I'm retiring, and I'm giving up this boarding house, or I'm giving up this business, and the business is for sale, or I'm moving. In other cases, you start to see an acceleration as you get closer to probably rumors about desegregation, which hasn't even hit Columbus yet. But it's the change of population, and Columbus is really a highly segregated city in the early part of the 20th century. And to some extent, we don't see it today. We shop in malls and grocery stores and we see diversity, and we don't realize our housing patterns still are relying on this. We do know that Fifth Avenue was a highly contested area. Italians and African Americans could not move north of Fifth Avenue into the University District, into what would be Victorian Village and other places. And in some cases, these weren't just deed restrictions. They were actually, when you get into Grandview, actually a city statute of where people could live and couldn't live.
We're talking about how high school students are learning about this kind of history with Doreen Uhas-Sauer. She started a oral history project with students from Fort Hays High School. Also with us is Miles Balfour. He's a Fort Hays High School student who participated in the project. And we've been talking about Milo Grogan, but we're also talking about, you know, how they learned about Milo Grogan. They did kind of that. They did the shoe leather approach and looked at the records and walked door to door and met people in person and did oral histories. This is another way of approaching history. We're going to talk about studying history, about learning about history and what makes it relevant and what sometimes can make it very distant to us coming up. So if you have a question or comment, want to talk about how you learned history, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about teaching history. Columbus historian Doreen Uhas-Sauer is working to change the discipline from back burner rote memorization to one that shows the relevance of the past on the present. WOSU Television's Columbus Neighborhoods has documented her work with Fort Hays High School students on an oral history project of historic Milo Grogan neighborhood. Check out the link at WOSU.org/allsides. The episode airs at 8:30 p.m. tonight on WOSU TV. And by the way, this oral history project about Milo Grogan is an ongoing project, and Doreen Uhasauer wants to let you know that they're still collecting oral histories. So it's still going on if you're interested in that. Joining us now by phone is history and journalism teacher David Cutler. David writes about teaching history for The Atlantic. We'll have a link to his latest article at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome, David Cutler.
Thank you so much for having me.
You wrote that history doesn't have to be boring. And, you know, it's what we all have thought over the years. What inspired you, despite your education, to pursue a degree in history?
Interesting. So I majored in history at college at Brandeis. And to be perfectly frank, I don't think I was quite ready to go into the real world. And I loved learning about history. And so I pursued my graduate degree. But I always loved learning about the past, and you know, based on your earlier conversations too, how the past influences decisions that we make today. And I wanted to share that love with younger people.
Are we missing out on anything though, not knowing the names and the dates and the serial numbers, kind of a thing?
Yeah. So I am not a fan of rote learning either, or rote memorization, and I'm glad to hear the other people on the line aren't either. I don't think so. I mean, in the age of Google and the internet, I don't think there's a need to know so many specific dates and names. What is important is that students have a command of the historian's craft and cause and effect, and certainly to have an idea of the timeline, to know about when the Revolutionary War happened, to know that it was before the Civil War.
Which some don't know, but go on.
Certainly, but I think that if we focus too much on rote memorization, it sucks the fun out of learning, and that's one of the reasons why I don't give multiple choice exams on my assessments.
You know, there was something in one of your articles that struck me. You had a very high achieving junior who had taken U.S. history from you as a junior come back at the beginning of her senior year, maybe over the summer, and she had aced the exam the previous spring, but she asked to take it again. What happened?
Yeah, that was actually, I believe, when I was teaching AP U.S. history.
Okay, gotcha.
A while ago, and I should say I'm no fan of the AP history curriculum. I know they have made some changes now.
Yeah.
I haven't taught it in a few years. But yes, no, exactly right. I mean, she was spending the year, you know, memorizing all of these inane facts without really any context. And the AP course as it then existed was you had to stuff so much information in your mind that it just came to be, you know, rote regurgitation. And so when she showed interest in taking the multiple choice section back in the fall, she didn't do nearly as well. All that information had left her head because it had no meaning to her.
And how have they changed the AP exam? Is it more essay and the context than dates and names?
Yeah, you know, I don't teach AP U.S. history any longer, and I don't want to comment too much on what I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do know is they've added short answer questions, which I think is a good change. They have in some way changed multiple choice, but I don't exactly know how. So I've stayed away since then.
Well, Doreen Uhasauer, how do you measure achievement on a project like this when you talk about an oral history project? How do you show the lawmakers, show the taxpayers what you've achieved or what the students have achieved?
Well, I think it's interesting. I love that his comment about AP New York, and I taught AP European, and it's the same thing. It's a very esoteric exercise, and you sort of wonder at the end, what have we all learned here? I'm not quite sure. And so for me, my background is actually European history, and it's church history, Reformation, and medieval. And somehow I am wildly drawn to local history. And I think once I finally admitted that to myself and let myself be free, I think that trying to show what you've learned from it is exactly what has been said. It's about the historian's craft. Are you asking the questions that will lead you to another question, to understanding? And that's why the Milo Grogan Project was interesting, because we're all impacted by immigration, industrialization, trends nationally and locally that are so overwhelming, and yet we don't see that really in the course of a year of our life, we have been impacted by these things. So at this point, I think that's really what lawmakers should be concerned about, is have you learned
how
to be a historian? Mm-hmm. Have you learned the importance of it? So I'm going to actually throw that over to Miles, because how would Miles describe what's important to have learned from a history project?
Yeah. What would you want to be tested on with this?
If I could be tested on this or anything, it would be, what have I learned that the people have learned from the past, in the sense that what advice have I been taught? I feel like I've been taught that a lot of the things in your life, like a lot of things can happen, a lot of change can come your way, and a lot of things can be unpredictable. And I felt like when I'm asking the people what are the hardest times they've gone through, how has the neighborhood changed, what it is that they remember, I just remember something from all of it, it's resilience, to just keep moving forward, that no matter what it is that's happening in the present, soon it'll be the past and you have to learn from it, or it's going to repeat and happen again. What I would like to be tested on is, how have I learned, how has history affected me, and how is it going to teach me to think about the future? How is it going to make me act? How is it going to make me think differently? How has it changed my mindset?
So, David Cutler, dream student?
Come on, anytime. I'd love to have you as a student and learn from you as well. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how to teach history. And, you know, we have Miles Balfour here. You just heard from him. He's a Fort Hays High School student, talking about how he's enjoyed learning about history through an oral history project with our other guest, Dorian Juhas Sauer, Columbus historian and education outreach coordinator for Columbus Landmarks. And also by phone, we have history and journalism teacher from Massachusetts and all, who also writes about teaching history for The Atlantic, David Cutler. We'll have links to his articles at WOSU.org/allsides. Columbus Neighborhoods, WOSU Television's Columbus Neighborhoods, has produced a segment, one of its episodes, about this project. That airs tonight at 8:30. PM, if you want, you can check it out online as well. We'll have a link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. So questions, comments about teaching history, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. 614-292-8513 is the number. Brian in Grandview, you're on the air. Hi, Brian.
Hello. I was listening to your program, and I was really excited. I couldn't believe it. I happened to stumble across the Milo Grogan. I hadn't heard it before. And it started out as I'm doing some research for the Pennsylvania Railroad Historical Society.
Oh.
Pennsylvania was a very big company here. I mean, it was one of the major companies back at the turn of the century. So I started researching that. My great-grandfather worked for the Pennsylvania Railroad. I was doing some genealogical research, found out that my great-grandfather, and it's kind of interesting how everything is real close. He was in the Spanish-American War, left at Fort Hays camp that was there, came back to Columbus after he was discharged. Moved two blocks away to Lexington Avenue, where my grandmother was born, and that's in Milo Grogan. But I was like really interested in finding out
more about this project,
about the neighborhood and stuff like that. Beg your pardon?
Well, you wanted to find out more about this project?
Yeah. I found it fantastic that somebody was working on the Milo Grogan neighborhood at the same time that I was researching it. I happened to be going to the Upper Arlington Library, and I picked up some old plats, some old survey plats that actually showed the streets and the way everything was located prior to, like, 670 coming in and changing everything. But so it was kind of interesting how I was able to see, you can see the Pennsylvania yards, the way they were back in the late 1800s, and then, like, my grandmother, I have a picture of her standing in front of the house that was on Lexington Avenue.
Okay.
in 1914. So she was 7 years old. But and then my grandfather, when he retired from the Pennsylvania Railroad, then ended up buying a house just south of the Park of Roses in Clintonville, which that at that time was the north end of Columbus.
Okay. You know, Brian, I hate to cut you off because this is really interesting. I wanted to ask, though, Doreen, is there someplace people can contact you with information about Milo Grogan?
Yes, I would love to
learned,
connect with this.
It sounds like Brian's a font of information.
I would love to connect with this gentleman. And I can be reached actually through Columbus Landmarks Foundation,
okay,
which is 614-221-0227.
Okay.
614-221-0227.
Okay.
And then I can connect that way if he leaves his name and number there.
All right, Brian. Thank you so much for that call. We're talking about teaching history today, teaching and learning history, what works, what doesn't. My guests, you just heard from Doreen Neuhaus-Sauer. She is working on a oral history project with Fort Hays High School students about the Milo Grogan area. Also with us, student Miles Balfour. And by phone, David Cutler, history and journalism teacher, and he writes for The Atlantic about teaching history. David Cutler, you're not into books, history books or history textbooks, I should say.
Yeah.
They're like kind of the worst in your book. No pun intended.
Well, yeah. You know, it's not so much that I dislike textbooks. It's more that I dislike an over-reliance on textbooks. When teachers use it as the only go-to source for knowledge, or teaching right out of the textbook all the time, that's what I think doesn't do students any favors. I mean, I think an over-reliance on any one source is a bad thing, but I try to expose students to as many different types of sources that I can, both primary and secondary, to really get them excited about the learning.
There's an aspect about textbooks, though, that I think you brought up in one of your essays, and it has to do with the static nature of a textbook, how it stops living once they write it down. There's not a sense of life to the history.
Yeah, you know, history is always changing, right? I mean, our interpretation of it changes over time too. There's a whole field of historiography that, you know, that goes into this. But certainly, so I think one of the bad things about textbooks is they're quickly out of date as to how we view the past. And then when they are up to date, you have to buy all new ones that cost a lot of money. And the publishers certainly don't hesitate to up the cost there. But it's a difficult task, a difficult challenge to balance these things.
Miles Balfour, what was history like before this class, or this project, I should say?
Just like you said, I've just been looking in a book, reading about the Revolutionary War and seeing how it shaped our nation and how it shaped our country, and it's just something that you're always detached from. When you look at history, like, oh, it happened in the past, and then you go on with the rest of the day and you don't think about it. But in this project, it reminded me that the things that people have experienced, like I said before, the interstate being built, and living through the time that JFK was assassinated, and looking and hearing people tell you they were on TV and they saw this historical event.
Yeah.
That reminds you that not only is it present even now, but it has an effect on you.
And you got all of this from doing these interviews. So this is much bigger than Milo Grogan then, right?
Right.
Doreen?
It is. I mean, Milo Grogan, we definitely want to say, is the star of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that all of us who worked on it don't want to take that away from Milo Grogan at all. And in that sense, it's just such a wonderful microcosm of what you can explain. It's interesting to talk about the American Revolution, for instance, because there's Fifth Avenue, the northern boundary, the refugee track.
Yeah.
Where do we get those people? After the American Revolution, coming into
refugee
Columbus
Road.
Because they've been given land. And so we have connections that we don't even know that we have. And that, I think, starts to make it a little bit more real, too.
Right. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you want to join the conversation, we're talking about teaching history. How'd you learn history? How'd you like to see it taught today? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the art of teaching history. Still with us, Columbus historian and education outreach coordinator for Columbus Landmarks, Doreen Juhas-Sauer. Doreen's work with Fort Hays High School students on an oral history project about the Milo Grogan neighborhood is highlighted in the latest episode of WOSU Television's Columbus Neighborhoods. That's at 8:30 tonight on WOSU TV. Check out the link at WOSU.org/allsides for more. Also with us is Fort Hays High School junior Miles Balfour, who participated in that project, and by phone, history and journalism teacher David Cutler, who writes about teaching history for The Atlantic. If you want to talk about how you learned history and what you got out of it or what you didn't, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. David Cutler, is this kind of a conversation? Are we really talking about higher level, you know, upper grade levels teaching, or is this an approach that can apply all the way down to kindergarten?
Look, I think this is an approach that, you know, could apply to any level. I mean, I only teach in the upper school, but can I just put one more thought in?
Sure.
About assessment. I think sometimes too students are turned off to history because of how teachers assess and you know, what they expect from students. And I've tried to do my best to allow students full credit retakes on, you know, in-class papers, most take-home assignments, mm-hmm. because I want students to know that I'm more concerned about their learning and their eventual mastery than just getting things right in a singular point in time. So I just don't only think it's how we show content, how we introduce content, but I also think it's how history teachers should assess performance that also plays a large role in whether students are engaged or not. So I've been really into that for the past few years as well.
Doreen, how did you figure student engagement on this? How did you start to see it or measure it or register it?
Well, I think in part you sort of do it intuitively as a level of enthusiasm. And when you start to talk about things, we would throw out little hints in class about Milo Grogan and actually even Cleveland Avenue as part of the Underground Railroad at one point. You're sort of watching all the time to see where that little spark has ignited. And then you start to build on it. And then you used food.
Donuts. Over, plenty of donuts.
What a good Texas sheet cake in the morning can do when you are
candy.
Offering it out there. And while you're munching, let me tell you about this. But
well, that's what we do with adults. So.
Absolutely.
Why wouldn't it work
right.
with kids?
It's like I've often believed, and in fact, this is kind of a good time to talk about this with assessment. We sometimes do things oddly with kids, like we give them boards and we make them do science projects and it's on a big board. I have never in my life seen anybody go down to city council with a board under their arm. But if I gave kids business cards, believe me, they change completely as to how they approach problem solving. And I think that's another part of the assessment that is interesting to think about. Miles is a very talented artist. His watercolors are amazing. Will Miles become a historian? I have no idea. And he may very well do that, or he may be drawn to something in history that reflects in his artwork. But I would like to think that Miles will pick up a newspaper sometime or read online or look at his phone, and we talk about affordable housing, and he'll remember Milo Grogan. And as an informed citizen, he is much more valuable to me than someone who may be trying to eke out a living as a history teacher in a school system and igniting things in his kids. He's now a citizen who's really willing to take on the challenge of problems we need to solve.
Does it feel that way, Miles?
It does. It feels really good getting recognized like that. Thank you. It felt like I have like a toolkit, and it felt like this entire experience has been me adding more and more to my toolkit, how to talk to people, how to ask questions, how to understand what someone has lived through. And like I've been saying before, empathy, how to connect with someone in their past and put yourself in their shoes. I feel like this project has only allowed me to grow more and more as a person, more than any other book could have taught me.
Ellen in Pickerington, you're on the air. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
I wanted to share an experience. I taught in Reynoldsburg with an amazing team of teachers and administrators, and our building was located right next to a Civil War cemetery. So rather than having the students read about the history of our area and our country. We went to the cemetery, they selected an individual, and then they researched that person's life. And they taught their fellow classmates about what was going on in that point. And they were connected rather than to a period or a date, they were connected to a human being. They looked at the culture, they looked at the food, they looked at the clothing. It was really a remarkable experience, and we turned a lot of kids on to history. And that was a middle school project, so when you ask about ages, it is how you make history come alive for students that engages them.
Thanks, Ellen. I appreciate that. Take care.
Thank you.
David Cutler, just another example, right?
Sure. Yeah, I think that's great. I'm a big fan of making students feel connected to the past in any way possible. If that includes going out of the classroom, that's awesome.
But I'm feeling like these skills that they're getting, the learning and just looking up primary sources, Doreen, things that we never did growing up. And
right.
David?
Yeah, well, I mean, I hope that's not true for everyone. I mean,
I'm old. Yeah, right.
No, I didn't mean to say that. I mean, I graduated in 2002, actually, where I'm teaching now, and I remember doing a lot of primary source work. But there are some things that stay true forever, and I think that's what history is learning how to interpret primary sources to, you know, create some idea of cause and effect. And no matter what I do, I always try to keep that in mind, that the end goal is, in fact, teaching the historian's craft. But there are many fun, engaging ways to do that. I mean, you don't just have to ask questions out of a textbook. We were talking earlier on about the Revolutionary War, mm-hmm. And how some students don't find that, you know, particularly interesting. I found great success asking students this question, which turns into a formal debate, which goes along the lines of, to what extent, if any, were the American colonists justified in rebelling against the British? And many students are like, well, what do you mean? Of course we were justified. Of course we were. But it's actually more nuanced than that, and it delves students deeper into the debate, and it also promotes self-learning, where students want to learn more beyond just what I present to them. Mm.
Do you raise questions in the process of this project, Doreen?
Oh, I think you always do, and I certainly do agree with him that you I think a good teacher raises more questions than actually has answers
exactly.
to provide
mm-hmm.
them. And the other thing we haven't really mentioned either, and I'm going to draw from Forte's experience on this, is we don't look across other curriculums as much as maybe we could. History and English, I taught both, and so it was an easy integration for me, or to work if I was teaching history with the English department or back and forth. But it really came home to me at Fort Hays maybe about 3 years ago when I was working on a special project with 6 or 7 seniors who were writing a paper, and I asked them if they would look at Columbus Landmarks list of endangered buildings that year. These were buildings that were in the threat of being demolished or possibly just falling into pieces or in a bad place, and no one wanted to develop them. And we looked at all 7 of them. I gave them a brief history. And all 7 of them, independently of each other, chose one of them, and that was the Macon Hotel, which is on the Near East Side. And so I thought to myself, okay, Macon Hotel. When I asked why, and they said, well, because we read Toni Morrison's Beloved. And I said, okay, help me here a little bit. And
I did too,
it wasn't,
but I'm like...
Right, because it wasn't Toni Morrison, it wasn't jazz, uh-huh. and it wasn't the jazz connection of the Macon Hotel. But for them, what they drew out of it from their English teacher was that all of us have ghosts, and the past have ghosts, and the stories must be told, or the stories are lost forever. And for them, the compelling story was the Macon Hotel. And that's why it was significant for them to think about.
Because they learned the idea from...
Mm-hmm. Sometimes we just don't take enough time, I think, to think about even a good quote in class, not to dissect it 26 ways as a primary source, but what does it say to you deep inside? Where do you relate to that? And I think that's what the literature end can sometimes do. And that's what it did in this case. So we crossed from a Toni Morrison novel to historic preservation in 5 minutes.
Is that cross-disciplinary tack something that you work with, David Cutler?
It's something that I would love to do more of, certainly. You know, sometimes we're so entrenched in our own silos, even within the communities that we're in, that we often don't think of things like that. You know, I'll tell you this, one thing that I'm not going to be able to do this year that I would love to do is when I teach about the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is to have one of my science colleagues come in and teach students a bit about nuclear energy. I think that would be a great crossover. As things go, sometimes life gets in the way or it's things are busy, but it just involves more planning, and I think it's entirely worth it. It's something that I want to do a better job of as a history teacher.
And likewise, do you think it's of interest or should it be of interest to the science teachers out there that somebody with a sense of history about the impact of nuclear power and the destructive force of it would teach in a science class?
Certainly. I think it would work out great. One of the impediments to doing that sometimes is scheduling and when different classes meet and how to get students in the right room at the right place and time. But the theory of it is, I think, extraordinary, and I think it would certainly engage learners and benefit multiple disciplines. It's just making sure you have all your ducks in a row, so to speak.
Do you get much pushback, David Cutler, you know, when you publish a piece in The Atlantic about teaching history and espousing your beliefs about changing how we generally approach it? Do you get pushback from other history teachers who say, you don't understand what I have to deal with?
It's funny. Not from my Atlantic pieces. I also write for PBS. And
that's right.
One of the pieces I wrote this year about Thanksgiving and the real history of Thanksgiving, which is not as pretty as many people like to think, received vitriol on PBS, and then Breitbart picked it up, and that was kind of I'm used to getting feedback when you put your voice out there, but this was kind of unreal for me. But certainly I get criticism and praise, but you know, I think the journalistic background in me, it accepts that. I mean, that's a truth. You know, we have to acknowledge that people will respond one way or the other. But I think that I wish more teachers would be willing to share their ideas, because I am by no means an expert at all. I just happen to love learning from others and hearing their ideas. And some of the best professional development I've received is just by writing these stories. And, I don't really get paid all that much, if anything, for them. I just I love doing it, and I wish it was something that more teachers would do.
Yeah, Doreen, you taught history for a long time. What's your sense about how the field is changing or not?
Well, you know, we can always bring up standardized testing and say it's definitely changed the face of education. And it certainly has. I mean, I see that from where I was 10 years ago to what I witnessed today. And the pressure is definitely on. But I think that what we don't talk about is the isolation that brings for the teachers. Teaching is, in a way, a very lonely profession. You are lucky if you see another adult, except by the copy machine. We used to have a colleague who would ask you in the morning, well, how are you? And then she would listen. And we were all amazed that she actually cared how we were. We were so busy, you know, just kind of blowing her off and getting on to something else. So once teachers can kind of break that down and they can find somebody else to work with, it makes a big difference. Or the alternative is you start, especially if you're teaching in high school, you start talking to your students as if they're adults. You don't treat them like
there's
the
an
other.
Idea.
You know, they are in this with you. And I think that gets a good response from students, that they understand that you're saying, you know, history has a lot of moral dilemmas. We have some every week that we have to face. And we're looking at the moral dilemma of whether or not you joined the colonists, or you stayed true to the crown, or we care about affordable housing, or why didn't anybody care where that freeway went? These were all decisions that had to be made at some time. And should we become more sensitive to this, we just become better people.
David, tell us about what you teach now, and tell us about something that you're teaching and how you're teaching it.
Yeah, like what am I currently teaching?
Yeah.
Yeah. So right now we're into World War II right now, but my students are also working on a debate which we'll have next week about FDR's New Deal and Second New Deal policies, and it actually fits pretty well into our conversation because students aren't just debating about the whether to what extent the New Deal helped America rebound from the Depression, but whether many of the policies that came out of the New Deal should still exist today. Are they still helpful? Like for instance, I don't know, Social Security, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's making a direct correlation to the past, and you know, students are finding more, I guess, energy, hopefully, to do their own learning beyond what I provide to them.
Doreen Juhas, however, before we wrap this up, I did want to talk more about Milo Grogan, at least the project that you're doing. You're going to have a book coming out. What else?
Well, we have Hollywood. We had actually started with the idea of a book and a book of oral histories, and then became so involved in everything we were collecting, and more was coming. But we don't want to forget that. So this opportunity to share this with WOSU has been extraordinary. But we need to get back down to brass tacks and try to put together exactly what the format of that book will be, and we'd like to have it out by the end of the year. You know, secretly in my heart, what I would really love is the ability to do this project in a lot of other neighborhoods in Columbus with high school students. I think that would be something extraordinary. Columbus is so fast growing, and we look at those millennials who come in from all of the other universities and places, and we forget what I call are the indigenous kids who grew up here. And I think they're the real treasures of Columbus. And for them to be able to start collecting histories of South Linden or the Hilltop or Clintonville, any of those places, I think it will start to open their eyes and they'll have more to share with each other and they'll understand the roots of that community. So for me, place is extremely important. And I think that when I worked with a group of high school kids a number of years ago at East High School, they gravitated toward Franklin Park across the street,
mm-hmm.
where they wanted to put in a dialogue bench, two benches facing each other, where people who needed to talk with each other. It was inspired by a civil rights book by John Lewis, that they had a place to talk and talk to each other. That's the kind of thing high school kids come up with. It's just extraordinary. I'd love to see more of that in Columbus. I'd love to see the city government embrace that. I think Columbus Landmarks Foundation is extremely interested in place and young people.
Yeah. And before I, you know, Doreen Juhas-Sauer, I just want to say thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
It's Doreen Juhas-Sauer, Columbus historian, education outreach coordinator for Columbus Landmarks, and we'll put a link to Columbus Landmarks on our website so that you can contact Doreen Juhas-Sauer if you have more to talk about regarding Milo Grogan. Miles Balfour, going forward, how does this change you?
Change. Okay.
I feel 30 like seconds.
30 seconds. All right, I got to move fast. Well, change. Mindset. I will say my way of approaching situations and problems and issues have changed dramatically. Also, it made me feel much more rooted and more interested in understanding my past and making those connections.
Good. Very well done. And David Cutler, thanks to you. I want to say thanks to you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
David Cutler, he teaches history and journalism in Massachusetts. He also writes about teaching history for The Atlantic and for PBS. We'll have links to his work on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also, we'll have a link to WOSU TV's Columbus Neighborhood so that you can check out the link to the broadcast of the episode about this project. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.